Can you tell me your name and a little bit about your role in the tribe?
My role in the tribe, I am a Gun Lake tribal elder. I represent the Three Fires Madewan Society, in which I have been following the life way for our indigenous people of the Anishinaabeg life ways for probably 30 years of my 54 years of life here. I am a community health representative, and I also sit on our education committee, our revenue share board. I'm a former tribal council member, and I am the founder for the Pink Shawl Project, which raises indigenous knowledge for breast health awareness and cancer. By us wearing our pink shawls in our dance circles, we are heightening that and tying those and strengthening those ties to one another, and it's a visual teaching that we see it versus a piece of black and white literature that you get at the doctor's office.
So how did the making of this documentary come about?
Oh boy, it's probably a documentary that, you know, if we were to document this long relationship going back millennia, talking about our creation story, the relationship between our sacred food, the Manoman, and that sacred Mega shell that presented and walked with us on our migration from the Great Salt Earth Sea. That walk, that migration, and that Migas instruction, it told us to go to a place where food grows on water. And that migration took approximately 500 years to take, because as we progressed westward, separate villages were established through the clan systems. And there became a turning point when the Anishinaabeg, a group of our people, went north and said they would follow the Lake Superior shoreline as far as they could. And those were the Ojibwe people. The Odawa said they would stay beneath the straits, and that Castle Rock that you see up by Mackinac Bridge is that marker. That's the territorial traditional marker for Ojibwe and Odawa people, and they said they would stay below, but they also controlled the straits when the colonizers came, so that gave them much greater access to the trade route. And then the Potawatomi people said they would follow the southern direction, and that's how we became established in and around the Lake Michigan shoreline from here and into Wisconsin and up into Wisconsin until you reach Forest County and Hannahville.
So basically what it sounds like is this wild rice in essence helped the Potawatomi to become a tribe.
It did. It solidified what we call the Three Fires Confederacy. Those are the three tribes that make up this confederacy. Back in, I want to say, the 1600s to 1700s, there was a need for tribes to collaborate and to marry one another for protection and just for the safety of our land and the protection of our Great Lakes. Because we had invaders from both sides. We had the Haudenosaunee people, the Iroquois people that wanted to take the rice beds as well. And then we had the Bowanek, also known as the Lakota people, that were intruding from the west, trying to reach those beds in Lake Superior at the farther western point of that lake. And so our people had to form this confederacy to protect those rice beds on all sides.
And so how much is wild rice a part of the Gun Lake tribe's diet, you know, even today?
Oh, today we use it almost for every celebratory reason that we can, for anniversaries, birthdays, traditional gatherings. We just recently had our first repatriation of two ancestors from the University of Michigan, and rice was part of that feast that went with them when we offered up their spirit plate. And that was a very historical day for us as far as reinterring our ancestors, our grandparents, as I refer to them. Ancestors makes it sound like it was so long and far away that we can't grasp within it. But if you use the word grandparent, that proves that direct lineage that we carry with those people that put those moccasin tracks here in this part of the earth.
And, you know, I've been told that Manoman is described as a very spiritual food. You know, what part of that makes it so spiritual for the Anishinaabeg people?
They refer to it as the, we have four sacred foods that we have to have present at any ceremony, whether it's a marriage or where we refer to our funerals as going back to our Mother Earth or marrying the Earth. And those four sacred foods are the manoman, the wild rice, the strawberry, or odaman in our language, which means heartberry, mandaman, the corn, and then nibeh, our fresh water. And those four foods are integral to part of the ceremony. You have to have those four foods. And we have to have either the fish or the venison to go with our manoman. And there's that balance of the water and the land in that one plate that we present to those ones, either through a marriage or a celebratory birthday, death. Represents the strength of the people. Strawberry is the heart of the people. Nibeh is the substance that sustains our sacred walk on this earth. And then mandaman is the essence of life. I don't know if you've ever smelled corn cooking and our indigenous corn, but it's a smell that, a sensory that connects us to those old ones that walked before us, seven generations before us, and we see it as a very, very beautiful connection to everything, kinegegu in our language, everything in creation, down to the smallest molecular phytoplankton, to the greatest beasts in the water and on earth. And we are all just a part of that cycle. And one cannot exist without the other. Human needs all of that. Humanity needs to exist and coexist with all of that perspective. But you don't need the ant family or the bird family doesn't need us as humans to sustain their life way on this earth.
Hmm.
So it's a very spiritual connection as well when we harvest the rice. There's a designated rice chief that keeps order and pridefulness for the work that you do. And he's the one that will check the rice beds daily, and then he will let families know when it's time to harvest the rice. And those families go to each part of their own traditional part of the lake where they have always riced. And it's like, how can I use this as an analogy? I don't know if you've been to Crow Fair in Montana, but they call it the teepee capital of the world. And those teepees that are placed closest to the center where they hold the dance for their week-long celebration, those ones have been there since the beginning. And those are the head people that have that access. So it's just like our rice beds. You know, the chief people would have beautiful rice beds, and it was their responsibility then to make sure that their people got those harvests.
So part of the film is about what you just talked about, you know, how mm-hmm. the rice is harvested, how it's cooked, how it's used. But the other part of the film is kind of getting to the kind of the nitty gritty of why we're talking about it, because it mm-hmm. is disappearing from West Michigan. You know,
right.
What are some things that are contributing to that?
I'd say climate change is a big part of any decimation of any living organism, animal, plant, bird here on this earth at the present time. I cannot state the direness that we are in. We are actually in a turning point that was prophesized by our people. And when we go to our ceremonies, we receive those prophecies through vision. Young people that go and fast, they come back with messages from our grandparents in the past. And we have been warned that it's time we have to change. And I can't tell you how important it is to know and to feel and to think that seven generations from this day, what our Earth Mother will be, the type of, will she be able to support life? And those are our future grandchildren. And that's always something that we've carried. We look seven generations past. I am supposed to announce seven generations past of my grandparents in the language when I enter that lodge, so that people know my line, know my clan, know where I came from. And that future and the hope in the future is that seven generations now, my grandchildren will be able to recite my name, my clan, and my line, and what I did in this life to try to make it balanced and better. And we've reached a point where that balancing and betterment of the world, of our Earth Mother, she is in dire straits. And when we have our full moon ceremonies, when we make that connection to our grandmother moon, she infiltrates those same distressful feelings. And because the earth suffers, we suffer. And I don't think it's how do I put this in a way that I don't want to offend, but the way we live now, with no respect, no offering back for what we take, you know, those are the reasonings things are happening in the earth as today, when we get those special edition news reports saying that somebody just shot up 14 people in a mental health facility in California. You know, Earth is affecting us, whether we realize it or not. And I don't think it's any, you know, reasoning other than to think that because the Earth is suffering, we are suffering as well. And the damage that we're doing and the fracking I know the Bad River community, Ojibwe community in Wisconsin is fighting to save their ancient rice beds that they've had for 1,000 to 2,000 to 3,000, 4,000, how many thousands of years from being annihilated by people who want to go into that area and mine. And when that mining happens, the poisons will cover the earth and the rice beds will die. They are also trying to take and break down just like our own DNA and play creator, play God. And these genome sequencings that are going on, it started out with plant and animal, but it's now going into the human aspect. And those things are in our prophecy teachings, that we were told that we're going to come and that would be part of our destruction.
And going back to climate change, you know, specifically what things are we seeing? I know that low water levels, so making it more difficult for the rice to grow is part of that. Well, I guess what other more physical changes are we seeing with those rice beds?
Well, we are seeing species invasions. The ash borer decimated our traditional black ash swamps, so our people are having a hard time finding that traditional method of making our baskets because the trees have succumbed. Other things that we see and hear is because in our worldview, you know, we don't look at miles and longitude and latitude. It's like if something is affecting the polar bear in that northern doorway, it affects us. And when we see glacier retreats, and when we see snowpacks that have been in existence since the beginning of time that are no longer there, you know, we know a new Earth will come, and Earth will cleanse herself, whether we're on board with it or not. She's done many landscape changes in the past, you know, to rid herself of life. You know, even our dinosaurs, we have a word for them in our language, Gitchikinabit, which means great or terrible lizard. And we have Winnebago coming and cleansing the earth of them. We have a story of the great flood, you know, very similar to the biblical story of Noah and his ark, where Winnebago used a giant sequoia tree as his great gemon or canoe, and the land animals were put on or allowed to stay on there. And when he asked who could go and get a bit of the earth from below the flooded earth, many animals rose up and said they would do that. Our great otter, beautiful clan, beautiful brother, beautiful sister, was asked first because Winnebago had complete confidence that he could go down into the depth and bring up a paw of our Earth Mother. He failed in his attempt. The second attempt, the hell diver, a great fisher duck that dives in deep down to retrieve his meal, volunteered and said, "I will go and get that earth for you, Winnebago." His attempt failed, and he went through many, many great swimmers and divers, and there was one last animal that sat to the back, and it was our little muskrat. And he raised his little paw and told Winnebojo, "I'm the last one, but I can do this." And I just pray, have people pray, the animals pray that I can do this, because I am the last one, and I feel everybody has no confidence in my ability to do so. So when he dove down, they say that he was down there for so long, and they thought that he succumbed to the depths. And then it was Mukwa who perched on that tree, that floating tree, that log, seen bubbles coming, and said, our brother is returning. And they all gathered at that to wait for that one to come up. And when he rose, he bubbled to the top. But when they opened his paw, he had that hand of earth with him. And he was the savior for our people. So there's a lot of these stories that we use to teach our young people that no matter how small or how inconfident that you may be, you always have a gift to do and a purpose to serve on this earth. And we as the Anishinaabe people were given that responsibility for taking care of our Earth Mother. So when we see the destruction and the pollution and the poisoning of our air and water, most of us that follow this traditional life way can feel that pain all the way back to those first sets of grandparents through our blood memory. I believe the scientific world has a term for that now, which they call epigenetics. And that is the ability to process trauma through the generations to your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren and your great-great-grandchildren. Anishinaabe people have always known this and have called it blood memory. Other tribes call it tissue memory or muscle memory or mind memory. But it's something we have never lost as an Anishinaabe people, that connection back so far that there's even vague recollections of that existence within our own selves now. But we know it's there because it was so long, so many, many thousands of years ago. You know, they want to keep pushing the Bering Strait theory on our people. And we just, you know, we laugh at all of this when we gather. Because our stories tell us that we came from the east and that we never migrated through the Bering Strait. But yet they can't or won't believe our stories, our traditional stories. They say we never had a written language. You know, you come to our Madewin Lodge, you will see our written language on our Earth Mother in the form of those sand scroll teachings. And where one symbol on the earth tells an entire story, an entire teaching, where we sit for 4 days when we become initiated and listen to the story of creation, listen to the songs. And they tell us that to sing those songs, because that's how the spirit talks, is through song. So we sing these beautiful, beautiful songs for creation. And we pray for our Earth Mother in those times that we are together 4 times a year, one for each season. And we try to incorporate our language now, a revitalization movement for the language, so our children are learning, so that they will be able to pray in the language. Pray and petition to those plant people, the animal brothers and sisters who stood up and said, I will watch over them and take care of them. I will offer my hide, my meat, my life, so that Anishinaabe can be here. And that's how we got our clan systems. You know, the bear clan, the deer clan, the fish clan, the turtle clan. Those all became about because they stood up for us and said, to use me so that you may live. And it's the same with the Manoman. She stood up and said, I will give them this food, which is part of my body, and they will live, and they will be strong. So there's a very spiritual connection to Manoman that I believe only Anishinaabe people can understand because of that aforementioned blood memory. And I would just like to maybe end on a quote from the Orenda by Joseph Boudin. He's a Métis writer from Canada. What's happened in the past can't stay in the past for the same reason the future is just a breath away. Now, what's most important, Atiastic says, spirit can't be lost, just misplaced. The past and the future are present.
Wild rice is also, you know, this has impacts for the wildlife too. Fish.
Mm-hmm.
What other wildlife are affected by, you know,
well,
in the rice fields?
Yeah, the water birds are huge consumers of rice, and we know that. We've always shared those rice fields with those brothers and sisters that we refer to as relatives. The ducks and swans love the seeds, and you know, and they can be a nuisance sometimes because they'll want to consume it all. And in the past, those rice beds, once they knew it was about to be harvested, they would put, each clan would send a family guard member to shoo the swans away, or which were the part of the colonization because swans weren't here before the colonizers came. But our natural waterfowl that are here, they know how to consume and balance where it's not an overabundance taken apart by our water birds. I am sure the fish use that as a area to give life and lay eggs because it's so protected. And their egg beds would be very safe and within a rice bed. And then you have the insects, which are an important part of both of those, both the bird and the fish diet. And then they would lay their eggs on the stems and be part of that circle of life within that rice bed as well. So, you know, it is so important to just understand that each and every part of life that is here and has a spirit is connected in one way or another to us. Somehow we will be affected if one does not survive or becomes extinct.
What are the things that you need to grow rice in these beds, and what is being taken away?
Okay. Fortunately, our cultural program has gotten seed locally. We know this is seed from Gun Lake, and we've also introduced seed from another lake near East Tawas, Higgins Lake, I believe. And that seed was introduced into some of our private residential lakes, land owned by tribal members. And some seed was put into the lake that is part of our cultural property at GJAC in Hopkins, Michigan. And we are going to wait until next spring to see if that seed has taken. And then once we know that we have established a rice bed, we'll monitor it and watch it. And we don't really know how long it takes to get to be a mature rice bed. I want to say 5 to 7 years, but that's how long, you know, they have envisioned this project to take to where it would become a full functioning rice bed where people can come out and harvest and take away and then have ceremony for that activity.
So the documentary, you're going to screen it in Grand Rapids at the Wealthy Theater on Wednesday, December 9th. And, you know, where else are you planning on showing this film?
I believe we will probably have a tribal member viewing, and then once it's on DVD, it will be distributed to the tribal members or put into our library system here. Or the Cultural Foundation will, of course, document this whole process and this whole story until we know that we have established those rice beds in our back in our area. But pollution, the environment, overpopulation of people, the destroying of wetland area to make it in a farmland, those have all been things that have taken away the rice from this area.
Are there any other organizations that are working with the Gun Lake Tribe to try and reestablish these rice beds?
Well, we have several tribal people that are essentially involved in the Saginaw, Chippewa, Huron, Potawatomi, Polk Hagen, Potawatomi, Gun Lake Band, a Little River Band of Odawa and Manistee. We are all trying to learn from one another. Scott Heron at the University and the Ferris State University in Big Rapids, he has taken it to another level as far as being in a college institution where things can be taught at that level. So universities, we have their input. Our environmental team here is very active and supportive and well-informed group of young men and women who dedicated their life as far as their work life here at the tribe to ensure that in 10 years we could have the fully functioning rice beds back in Southwest Michigan.
Well, Punkin Shenanigans, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you again.